morning. My name is Michael McCusker. We are now entering the Caesarean zone, the two summer months that acclaimed the Roman dictators, Julius and Augustus, after which, as a result of the insertion, the following other Latinesque months are in perpetual numerical disorder until Janus, the two-faced god. I start with a screed I wrote and usually orate every Liberty Month on this program, and I call it Sons of Liberty. 245 years ago, on July 2, 1776, a small group of terrorists betrayed their country and vowed to commit any and all sorts of violence and treason, which they claimed would be necessary to separate from their government. 2 days later, July 4th, they publicly declared their intention of betrayal and categorically stated their reasons for turning against their country, and they threatened to murder or otherwise terrorize all who did not join them. They first began their terrorist acts several years earlier. They burned, looted, tortured, murdered, kidnapped, and held hostage representatives and supporters of their government. They ambushed and killed soldiers and policemen. Numerous attempts at negotiation only increased their demands and brutality until finally the previous year, in April 1775, they committed open rebellion by attacking government forces sent to protect loyal citizens from their terrorism. The terrorists cloaked their atrocities and treachery with a specious document that claimed the support of God and the sympathy of humanity. They named their perfidious sedition a Declaration of Independence. And now, the Assumption of Freedom, which I also wrote as a critical commemoration of the Firecracker Festival. July is a month celebrated as the birthday of the United States of America. In 2021, Yankee Doodle is 12 score and more, and its founding principles of liberty and justice for all. The larger voices loudly proclaim the USA as the freest, most wonderful country on earth, and unfurl the flags of worldly preeminence and godly jingoism. Smaller voices disagree, which is not to say the ideals of liberty and justice for all are not articulate in the nation, or that their intent is less than political and personal freedom, and something akin to equality under the law, however discriminatory its actual practice, for everybody now and in the future who live within its geospace. The persistent conundrum is that the actuality is far less than advertised, that neither freedom nor equity is the daily reality for millions of Americans who are governed instead as if they live in a police state because they are poor or are of a minority race, that the old evils of worth measured by wealth, gender, and race continually and perversely undercut the foundations the nation claims to stand upon and believe in. The oldest struggle after survival is for freedom, of being part of a community, not enslaved by it. The eternal pitiless struggle between haves and have-nots. The despairing rage of those condemned to live bitterly wretched lives in the shadows and as menials to the economic and politically powerful few who are, in their turn, angrily terrified by this rage. History shrieks with the pain of injustice, only briefly muffled by excesses of gross brutality. Sometimes the oppressed overthrow the lords and bosses, but elites always rise in even the most originally classless societies. If the American Revolution is accepted as more than a revolt of colonial bourgeoisie and that it gave birth to an entirely egalitarian society in which the common citizenry had a chance to be their own rulers. It should also be realized that every reform has been bitterly and often bloodily resisted and only adopted with great reluctance. Reforms that have been ratified are usually countered with vicious backlash and unrelenting reversion. Vernon Carrington believed that American history has been, quote, largely a struggle between the spirit of the Declaration of Independence and the spirit of the Constitution, the one primarily concerned with the rights of man, the other more practically concerned with the rights of property, quote, unquote. Carrington could not understand why intelligent Americans confused the two and thought of them as complementary. Their unlikeness is unmistakable, he wrote in Main Currents of American Thought. The one, a classical statement of the French humanitarian democracy, the other, an organic law designed to protect the minority under Republican rule, quote, unquote. Historians have long debunked his ideological division of the nation's two most important documents. Yet, as early as the 1820s, Alexis de Tocqueville observed, as R.R. Palmer wrote, that equality was one of the most fundamental ideas of the United States. But he also thought that the American Revolution had been of little importance in producing this spirit of equality. Or as Nicholas Chamfort put it, society is composed of two large classes, those who have more dinners than appetite, and those who have more appetite than dinners. Those two classes form a single system, Henry Adams wrote, and that system is the price at which the proletarian is to be bought and sold, the bread and circuses, unquote. George Bernard Shaw said, a government that robs Peter to pay Paul can always count on the support of Paul. The obsession for world power, which is America's self-proclaimed manifest destiny, has given it the myopic paradox of patriotic corruption. General Eisenhower said in his farewell speech as president in 1961, every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired, signifies in a final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. And that was Ike. Nationalism, a packaged product that disguises inequities and rot within a nation, while simultaneously promoting the imperial ambitions of a powerful and avaricious minority, is a prerequisite for expansion, primarily economic colonialism in this new millennium, and ideologies, which are fictions, are yet justifications for tyrannies and terrorisms, large and small. The greater cost is the ultimate loss of liberties in the holy names of national defense and national security. Government hides its clandestine acts against foreign nations and its own citizens under official secrets classifications, which deny access to the citizenry. Operating away from public scrutiny and on behalf of the narrow interests of the elite few, the government cloaks its corruption with pieties of patriotism and the blessings of God. Our cultural pashas proselytize our obviously superior and enlightened supremacy to a wary and suspicious world, while subverting opposition at home to our post-Cold War mode of Pax Romana. War is the enemy of democracy, Howard Zinn says unequivocally. He might add that militarism leads both to war and domestic subordination and is as much the nemesis of freedom. The assumption of freedom is that the average human being is intelligent and inspired by compassion, and that most people will think and act reasonably most of the time. The usual assumption of government is the common citizenry is unintelligent, primitive, and brutal, and must be shielded from its own perfidious nature. the tendency of government is to rule, and it is a parasite. Government must, by the implication or force of its sovereignty, feed upon and subtract the political liberties, rights, and powers of those it rules. It is the responsibility of the people to always contain the power of their government, which, without that restraint, will relentlessly take away power from the people. In the past century and more, the U.S. government has usurped much power for itself, some of it for the betterment of the people, such as civil rights laws, but also much of it against the people, such as the rule of terror, secrecy, and doubt that characterized the Cold War and nuclear arms race with the now defunct Soviet Union. The idea of the authority of law is a recognition by most of us that a few of us will cheat, rob, murder, and otherwise make life uncomfortable for the rest. A majority desires protection from the psychopathy of an avaricious minority for exactly the same purpose, to protect us from predatory or cruel government. The political freedom and power of the common citizenry has been made the law of this nation. Yet a government of the people is assumed to also be a government for the people. So it is entrusted to act in the people's behalf, to prevent or correct the excesses of monopolistic and unprincipled private interests, which is in contrast to the current era of virulent capitalism. Former President Reagan was wrong when he said that a free government must be free from government. The dismantling of government protections, which has accelerated since his administration, alters government's role from acting as benefactor and protector of civil rights and liberties to its more ominous nature of a guardian and enforcer of the reigning status quo, which is increasingly articulated by the wealthy elite and the religious right. Freedom implies a mature citizenry, while the nature of authority requires that no one grow up. To be free and remain that way is a large responsibility, and many people don't want it. Political freedom insists upon the value of the individual, but the accelerated complexity of American society is constructed on aggregates and consensus and makes the contributions and usefulness of each of us less valuable. Our thinking and sense of self-worth are critically affected. An individual and ultimately collective sense of personal and political helplessness settles in. Our freedoms seem to be only wishful lies, bedtime tales told by those we democratically select to Alka-Seltzer our minds of thought or responsibility. Reality is treated as event, which translates into what entertains. Almost everyone seems apprehensive of the period we are trying to live through, and of this new century we step warily into, an unscripted frontier without too many horizons. Zestful prophecies of humanity uber alles are proclaimed, as our apocalyptic visions. The law of parsimony is not helpful. The simplest answer is probably the wrong one. If God is dead, who is there but Homo Jones to believe in, the great 19th century idea that made the 20th century a maelstrom of hubris and horror? From top to bottom, the whole system is a fraud, Henry Adams wrote. All of us know it, laborers and capitalists alike, and all of us are consenting parties to it. He thought the entire society would go to rack if we really lay hands of reform on our rotten institutions. Forrest Amston, former news director of KGW-TV in Portland, he died in 1990, wrote that the federal and legislative branches of the U.S. government are so corrupt that reform requires insurrection. James Madison argued 230 years ago in 1791, when he introduced the Bill of Rights to the Constitution as its first 10 amendments, that the people, not the government, possess the absolute sovereignty. Abraham Lincoln said that if the people retain their virtue and vigilance, no administration, by any extreme of wickedness or folly can very seriously injure the governmental concepts of our founding ancestors. We can have a democratic society, or we can have a concentration of great wealth in the hands of the few. We cannot have both, Louis Brandeis said. If we wish to take hope and some encouragement in the long struggle ahead to right the balance of power in this country, perhaps it is not too late to agree with James Boyle, who wrote in the New York Times, and who I quote many times, "One reason we have a democracy is because people make unspeakably stupid decisions without it." And that was An Assumption of Freedom, which I wrote. And now, by Dr. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington, "We Have No Right to Vote." Imagine if contemporary Americans were asked to vote on adoption of the U.S. Constitution as originally drafted, stripped of all changes over the last two centuries. Our nation of more than 330 million lives in a time and place where, as President George W. Bush pledged in his second inaugural address, "It is the policy of the United States to seek and support the growth of democratic movements and institutions in every nation and culture with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world." And that was George W. Imbued as we are with that spirit, if we were transported back to the winter of 1787-88 and asked to vote on the Constitution, we might recoil at some of its provisions. The original document establishing our government acknowledges and weaves slavery deeply into our society. Women cannot vote. Two of the three major federal offices, president and senator, are not voted on by the people, and there is no right to vote in the Constitution. The word "vote" appears in the Constitution only in relation to how representatives, senators, and presidential electors perform their duties. Representatives vote. In fact, while they are performing their duties in the House, they are immune from arrest for most crimes. But the people's vote is not mentioned. Consequently, an individual's vote is neither protected nor guaranteed. The phrase "right to vote" simply does not appear in the Constitution, nor does it appear in the Bill of Rights. The founders wrote a constitution that gave Congress the right to pass copyright and bankruptcy laws, the right to borrow money, the right to establish post offices. Exactly how long is a mile? Congress is granted the power to say, in other words, to fix the standards of weights and measures. Congress was required to keep a journal of its proceedings. Members of Congress were guaranteed a salary. Amid this wealth of detail, scarcely a word is spent on how the people are to vote or how their consent to be governed is to be assessed. Even in the wake of the Bill of Rights, which made a slew of individual rights explicit, the Constitution did not mention a right to vote. The right to assemble and petition government was established. The right to keep and bear arms, to a jury trial, to a speedy trial in criminal cases, to due process of law, to confront witnesses in criminal cases. Yes. Voting rights, no. It's almost as if, in the course of constructing a house, the contractor ordered the refrigerator and stove, the windows and curtains, the roof shingles, bought all the interior paint, and built the swimming pool, but he completely forgot about the foundation. Of course, the founders were not so oblivious, and contrary to many common accounts, they were not stiff-necked, anti-democrat elitists, hostile to the swarm of unwashed voters. But during the hot summer in Philadelphia in 1787, when they were writing the Constitution, the old adage that politics is the art of the possible held sway. The decision not to address voting rights in the Constitution was not an oversight. It was a pragmatic decision. it was not politically practicable to impose uniform suffrage, i.e. voting laws, across the original colonies. If the founders had tried to do so, they would have ignited a conflict among states, each of which had distinct traditions and approaches to voting. A uniform federal approach to voting would have overridden some states' traditions and inflamed a substantial number of the states needed for the document's ratification. Was the new, fragile federal government really going to tell South Carolina that free blacks could vote? Or was it going to have to do the opposite and tell Massachusetts, which did allow blacks to vote, that it would have to ban their voting? A uniform federal voting system was a bridge too far. Easier to let state laws and provisions dealing with the vote stand. After all, almost all elections were local. Only one of the newly created federal offices was subject to direct popular vote. Neither senators nor the president were elected by the general population. Only members of the House of Representatives stood before the people before election. The Constitution, in effect, integrated whatever the states might say about the right to vote into the new federal system. Each state was required to have a Republican form of government, but no more than that. In the time that passed, once our founding document was adopted, nothing has been more sharply disputed than our voting rights. Not taxation policy, not government regulation, not our safety net, Social Security, Medicare, welfare, not railroads, not the internet, not freedom of speech, not health care. Nothing rivals the intensity of, the importance of, or the blood spilled over our nation's debate on the right to vote, a subject that was ambiguously and elliptically avoided in the Constitution. Today, in the wake of a civil war that left more than 600,000 dead, 8 constitutional amendments, 2 monumental social protest movements, the youthquake of the 1960s, the transformative lawmaking of Congress in 1965, and the convulsions of the 2000 presidential election, most Americans feel reasonably confident that they have something approaching a right to vote. Or maybe it's just a privilege. To a degree, the easiest way to think about our voting rights system is as a sedimentary rock formation, its layers laid down and intermingled over centuries with federal and state constitutional provisions, laws, and regulations evolving over the course of our history. But the fundamental layer, the right to vote, has never been laid. Sure, there is no overreaching federal right to vote in our Constitution. On a national level, the right to vote might best be understood in the negative. The United States has universal suffrage, almost. The vote cannot be denied to a citizen on the basis of race, gender, age, once the voter is age 18, our ability to read or to pay a toll tax. But some categories of people can still indisputably have the right to vote denied. Felons or non-citizens, for example, an individual's vote cannot be diluted, made to count less than another person's. However, as simple as it might be to formulate the principle, one man, one vote implementation is not nearly so straightforward, and the right to vote, to the extent there is one, must be equally protected. Though, like one man, one vote, implementing equal protection is not clear-cut. Beyond that, whether one has a right to vote is largely a matter of state law. The right to vote in the most practical sense, the way people cast their ballots and have them counted, can be restricted and made difficult in numerous ways. And whether efforts to restrict the ability to vote go too far is determined by a blend of state and federal law. The bottom line, voters in the United States simply have no constitutional right to vote for president. The fact that Americans can vote for the electors, who then vote for the president, is a generous gift given by state legislatures. They are free to take it back whenever they want. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk engineers this program. Remember to ease out of the plague carefully, with all flags flying as well, fireworks even. It is not over yet, but liberation is nigh if we use our heads along with our heartfelt desires of freedom from epidemical chains. Happy Plague Independence Day.